There are some things that we in the Midwest do better than anyone else in the world. One of those things is pie. This hour, a collection that celebrates Midwestern food, including pie. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. In the new book, Fried Walleye and Cherry Pie, Midwestern writers reminisce about family recipes and food traditions, strange food experiences, and cultural phenomenon. We'll talk with editor Peggy Wolf and two Iowa writers who are included in the collection, Jeremy Jackson, author of the Cornbread book, and Mary Kay Shanley, author of Our State Fair, Iowa's Blue Ribbon Story, and other books. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. We are just over a week away from the biggest food day of the year. And this hour, we're going to talk about our Midwestern food traditions, including a good old-fashioned farmstead Thanksgiving. The new book, Fried Walleye and Cherry Pie, Midwestern Writers on Food, brings together contributions from all over the Midwest. And this hour, I have with me the editor of the collection, Peggy Wolf, who's based in Chicago. Hello, Peggy.
Hello, Charity. Thank you so much for having me here. It's a pleasure.
Thank you for being with us today. I also have with me two Iowa writers who are included in the collection. Jeremy Jackson is here. He is the author of the Cornbread book and a few other books about food, and also most recently the memoir, I Will Not Leave You Comfortless. Hello, Jeremy.
Good morning, Charity.
Welcome back to
Thank
the show.
You.
Mary Kay Shanley is also here. She is the author of a number of books, including Our State Fair, Iowa's Blue Ribbon Story. Mary Kay, thank you so much for being
thank
here today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, and Peggy, I want to start with you. In the introduction of the book, you write about an exchange you had as a child with a Midwestern food icon, Betty Crocker. Tell me what happened.
Okay, Betty Crocker. When I was about 11 years old, I cooked up her chocolate chip cookie recipe, and it did not come out like the picture in the book. They were not gooey in the middle. In fact, they never gelled. And I was very disappointed, and what we did in our family was we wrote letters. And so I sat down and I wrote a hate letter to Betty Crocker. And my mom figured out where to send that up to Betty Crocker at General Mills up there in Minnesota.
And what did you get back?
I got back from Betty, who would have been for my generation like the Martha Stewart of your generation. Mm-hmm. I got back a cookbook that had very simple recipes and another cookbook, a companion on how to measure. And the note, I wish I had it with me today. The note said something like they test all their recipes in the Betty Crocker kitchen, and I got a set of measuring spoons, colored.
That's so great. And now, of course, you had written this hate letter, but in getting this personal response from a corporation, really, and this personalized advice on how to make your recipes come out, how did that change you as an 11-year-old?
I would say that it secured my place in the kitchen, because to get a package from Betty, she had gotten letters from Eleanor Roosevelt, who was in Africa, and they were trying to figure out how to improve the flour over there. And she wrote back to Eleanor Roosevelt, and she wrote to me. So I was rubbing elbows with celebrity. It did a lot for me.
And that's the beginning of your food journey in life that has led us, among other places, to here. What gave you the idea for this collection?
Okay, so this collection of 30 food stories from very reputable Midwestern writers like the ones who are joining me here, Jeremy and Mary Kay, I felt that the Midwest was underrepresented, that the Midwest got a bad rap. And we're called flyover country and a bunch of other things. And I feel that the Midwest is a hidden gem. So I wanted to tell stories and to give a portrait of the Midwest through food stories, whether they're family dramas, whether they're about tradition or change, through the lens of food.
And I think there are, of course, are so many stereotypes about the Midwest. And one of the stereotypes about food in the Midwest, this would be one of the more positive stereotypes about food in the Midwest, is the idea that it's all meat and potatoes, home cooking. And there is certainly that element to your collection. Did you make a conscious effort to try to include that, but also have a broader palate?
Yes, I did. That's very insightful. This is a region full of tradition, that's full of home cooking, unpretentious meals, the meat and potatoes, but also change. We've made huge strides forward in ingenuity, in ingredient sourcing, and techniques. There's a restaurant that I found up in Kalamazoo, Michigan, called Food Dance, where they are bringing in animals to the back room, and they've already been slaughtered, but they're dismantling the animals in back of the kitchen. So they know the farms that are growing, whether it's lamb, beef, hog, chicken, and they have relationships with farmers. So one of the things I wanted to do in this book was to tell people that every trend you see on the East Coast or the West Coast, eating locally, the least traveled food and so on, is happening here in places like Kalamazoo.
Well, and of course, you are based in Chicago, which is a city pretty well known for food. What made you want to look outside of Chicago and the other big cities that do have a more positive reputation?
Let's see. Well, to be Chicago-centric, Chicago's not exactly the Midwest. Chicago is Chicago. And I found it so interesting, Charity, that when I put out query letters to lots of authors, that nobody wanted to write about molecular gastronomy. And, well, that's a good thing. So, because that's a trend, and it's certainly very prominent in Chicago restaurants. I think it was just natural to look outside Chicago because, as I saw in, you have a restaurant called the Machine Shed, and I went to it in Des Moines, and I think their flagship sign says something like, "The farmer is our bread and butter." So I needed to look outside Chicago.
And how did you define the Midwest? Because there are people who will quibble with any Midwestern definition. But how did you define it for this book?
Okay, well, I think if you look at how the government defines it, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, any of these people, it varies from 10 states to 12 states. So I started in Ohio, okay, even Western Pennsylvania will consider itself Midwestern, but I had to draw a line. Ohio and as far west as Nebraska, not Colorado. That's a mountain state. And yes, it can include North Dakota and South Dakota, but I lopped those off because a lot of people go, well, those are plain states, you know. So I created 10 states on my own map.
All right. And how did you go about finding the contributors?
Thank you. I looked for very reputable writers, and I made a list, my wish list, and I began. And I started sending out letters. A woman I worked with, her name's Harriet Bell in New York, knew Jeremy, and she said, take a look at Jeremy. And I looked at his cornbread book. I read their writing before I sent out a letter. Some of them I already knew. Jacqueline Michard, I had read The Deep End of the Ocean. I had seen the film with Michelle Pfeiffer. Yes, the book is better than the movie. So Elizabeth Berg, I had read pieces of hers. Some of them I was acquainted with. So I made a huge wish list. And they went from National Public Radio radio hosts to a chef to Guggenheim Fellows, New York Times wonderful book writers that have been, you know, award winners there. So a real different collection of voices, that is what I wanted. Very few of them have a background in food.
And Did they get to choose what kind of food they would write about?
Yes and no, because I had a lot of people who wanted to do pie. And I could have recast this entire book and called it The Midwestern Sweet Tooth. Because, for example, two of my writers wanted to do an iconic Chicago food, which is the Italian beef. And my feeling was, well, the first one who really jumps on this gets it. So I made a list of foods, and pork was on there, but none of my writers wanted to do elected pork. So I found an Iowa writer. His name is John Yates. He now works at the Chicago Tribune. He's a columnist. And I wrote to him. I had read a lot of his writing. He's come out with a book. And I said, would you take on pork? Oh, was he happy.
And Jeremy, you got pie. How did you get that lucky?
I don't even know how I got pie. I think my pitch was I want to write about church basement potlucks, you know, and somehow my essay turned into pie. I'm not sure. I blindsided Peggy. I don't remember.
You got lucky at
least.
Yeah,
right? I guess so.
And Mary Kate, did you choose Thanksgiving, and was that the subject? Or,
well, excuse me, when Peggy asked me to participate, I told her I wasn't a food writer, and she said she knew that and that she'd read my stuff, and she said, you tell me what you want to write about. And I knew within a week that I was going to write about Thanksgiving dinner on my cousin's farms, and I just kind of let things percolate inside of me, and then it comes to me. So pie is part of it, but it's a lot bigger. I mean, I didn't fit into the pie category.
You can just slip a little pie in there.
There's a little pie in there.
And Peggy, you chose to write about a fish boil in Wisconsin, which I guess it's iconic in Wisconsin, although being from Iowa, I hadn't actually heard about the fish boils. What made you want to write about that?
I had gone to Wisconsin on a bike trip in 1985, and I met a man who would become my husband. And so there we were, 20 of us, at a fish boil, and I couldn't believe people would drop fish into boiling hot water and it would taste good. But it did. But it did. And I took my family back there, and we attended a fish boil. I knew I had to write about it. It's a Midwestern tradition.
All right. Well, we will talk more about the fish boil and Thanksgiving dinner and lemon meringue pie and many other foods in a moment. You're welcome to join our conversation as well with your favorite Midwestern foods or food traditions in your family. Give us a call at 866-780-9100 or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa.
Fram sauce with the awesome fee with Shafafa. On the side, I don't want pork chops and bacon. That won't awaken my appetite inside. I want the fram sauce with the awesome feet with Shafafa on the side.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, I'm talking with the contributors of the new collection, Fried Walleye and Cherry Pie, Midwestern Writers on Food. Midwestern writers from all over the region have written about many different kinds of food for this collection. With me today is the editor, Peggy Wolf, also Jeremy Jackson, author of the Cornbread book and a number of other books, and Mary Kay Shanley, author of Our State Fair, Iowa's Blue Ribbon Story, and 9 other books. And they've all written, Jeremy wrote about lemon meringue pie, Mary Kay wrote about Thanksgiving dinner, and Peggy, we were just talking about that fish boil in Wisconsin that you wrote about. And maybe I'm just culturally deprived, but I had never heard of a fish boil before. So can you describe what it is for other people who may be as culturally deprived as I am?
You know, this is one of these cultural, let's say, culinary traditions that when you go to Door County, you haven't truly been to Door unless you had a fish boil. And there are probably 85 boils a night in summer. So this is a... It's a real moneymaker from the restaurant's point of view. But it used to be 150 years ago when Scandinavians settled that area of the country. So if you think of Wisconsin, the way the state looks, it's the thumb sticking out into Lake Michigan. That's Door County. It used to be a way of feeding the fishermen who were out on their boats all day, and they were catching whatever they could from Lake Michigan. And on the way back, they were hungry. I think it was lake trout in those days. And they did boil water, a big pot of water on the boat, and threw the fish in to eat, and it did boil over because the fish had a lot of fat. It's cold water. So you go around Door County, and you will hear that this tradition was born in lumber camps, you know, and whichever origin you want to believe, they were used to feeding large groups of people.
And the boiling over is a big part of the act. I mean, people watch the fish boil, and the chef who does the fish boil gets to put on kind of a show. And what happens when it boils over?
Okay, so I'm going to call him the boiler master.
All right.
Okay, or the master boiler. What happens is the crowd has to stand back, and he has thrown in a pot of red potatoes. They take 30 minutes. About 7 minutes before the potatoes are done, he lowers a basket of pretty oily fish, and he throws kerosene onto the fire underneath it, which I explained in my own essay. My head popped back like a Pez dispenser to see this flame shoot up, and the water boils over with the fat in it.
Okay.
And voila, he takes the basket out, and you have cooked potatoes and cooked fish.
So there's basically an explosion, and the water also douses the fire. Is that or not?
The water doesn't really douse the fire. Okay. It helps to calm it down,
okay.
But that's it. And the guy screams at people to stand back. On one of the nights, a woman's hair got singed.
Ooh. That's horrible. All right. So, and I couldn't help but notice that although you wrote about a fish boil, what, a third of your essay is devoted to pie. So you, like everyone else, wanted to write about pie. And you wrote about the tart cherry pie.
I did, because that finishes off the meal. The fish boil all over Door County is the same wherever you go. It is the fish. It is the red potatoes, not Idaho whites, our little tea breads, and Door County cherry pie.
Nice. All right. Well, let's move on to Thanksgiving dinner with Mary Kay Shanley. And Mary Kay, do you have just a little bit of your essay that you could read for us?
Well, I do. Let me give you just a tad of background.
Great.
This was before I can remember, I would go up to my cousin's farms for Thanksgiving, and that was in the early 50s. And in the end, when I started to tell the story, I think that I traced the changes in family, the traces in farming and in food between then and next week. So two things remained steady all the time. One was the pie. You never brought store-bought pie. And the other thing was Jell-O. So I'll read you a little passage. When we're at the table, as changes are going forth, and this is probably by then in the 70s, we still pass the staples, strawberry Jell-O with shredded carrots, lime Jell-O with crushed pineapple, and occasionally orange Jell-O with miniature marshmallows. Then, one year, my mother's bowl of Jell-O deviated from the family norms, majorly. Cherry Jell-O with little white balls suspended throughout. The bowl joined the endless procession following the potatoes and the gravy and the corn around the table. The procession stopped abruptly when somebody handed the bowl to Jerry, who looked into the shimmering maroon to wonder at what those little balls were. "What the hell is this? Is in this Jell-O?" he asked. "Jerry, hush," his wife said. "No, really, what's in this Jell-O? Who made Jell-O with white balls?" "Jerry, hush." "I did," my mother leaned forward. "From a recipe in Better Homes and Gardens, you soften some cream cheese and make little balls out of it with a melon ball scoop. I had to go clear back to Hy-Vee just to get one of those scoops. Your magazine said to put cream cheese in the Jell-O? You are kidding, Irene. Jerry, hush. Yes, my mother replied. I think you'll like it. My bridge club did. And so did Jerry, because by this time, my mother had become the matriarch of our extended family. That's probably why she and the other women her age were finally eating with the men.
That's such a wonderful story. And I was surprised, in maybe, again, cultural ignorance, but when you described that, those the early Thanksgiving dinners mm-hmm. with your Grandpa Henry mm-hmm. at the head of the table, all the men in the family ate first and all the women waited till later?
There were 16 chairs. That's how many they could get in. And all the men, and then the oldest of the boys that were going to farm the next generation of farming would sit down. And when all the chairs were full, then the younger boys had to wait and eat with the women and the girls.
Wow.
And that's how it was. And that was... I would say that was well in close to the 60s.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you would all file into the dining room to say grace before the meal.
And then the women would go back in the kitchen and the girls would serve and the boys would just wait around. And that's the way it was. And it wasn't just our family. That was very much we were a German farm family, and I think I don't know about farm families from other origins, but it was very, very German tradition.
Interesting.
Very much.
And did you, when you were growing up, did you question it? Did you think, this
by the time
seem fair?
When I got into college in the early 60s, it's like, this doesn't seem right. And I went to college in Omaha, so a lot of my friends were from the Midwest, and that was, if they had any farm connection, that's the same way for them. And then one year, my cousin who was younger, but she'd gone to college. She was in college by then. And one of the men said to her, they said, "Mary, go get me some water." And she turned around and she said, "Get it yourself." And I thought, "Oh, good for you." So, but change comes slowly,
right.
And it took generations.
Took generations. Well, and of course, with generations passing, change probably became easier.
It did. In fact, I say it in the book too, that the closer we got to where we are today, 70s and 80s and 90s, the more profound some of the changes were, and the biggest one that I had noticed up till then was that I brought home a Protestant boy. And we got married, and it was like, whoa. A couple cousins said, he's not Catholic. I said, yeah, I know.
I'm aware of it. Oh, that's funny. Well, I love the Jell-O description. And you could devote a whole book to Jell-O. I mean, there have been books devoted to Jell-O, but it's such an important fabric of our Midwestern culture. And Mary Kay, you've recently rediscovered Jell-O.
I hadn't made Jell-O for I don't know how long. And long, long time. And then when Peggy was going to come here and we were going to start to be promoting the book a little bit, I thought I should make Jell-O. And I have an old cookbook that has church women's cookbook with church women recipes in it. And, of course, Jell-O would be 50% of the book practically and pie the other 50%. And I thought, oh, well, I'll look in there. And I've now made two kinds of Jell-O. And, you know, that I'm not just where you just make the Jell-O out of the box. And it's like, oh, yeah, I grew up on this. So there you go. Jell-O isn't dead yet.
No. And it originated in Nebraska? So I guess that's beyond the Midwest for you. No, Nebraska was included, right?
No, Nebraska is the Midwest.
Right, right.
Oh, yes. There was a chemist who came up with Jell-O from Nebraska.
All right. And it changed many, many dinner tables over the years. I'm talking with contributors to the new collection, Fried Walleye and Cherry Pie, Midwestern Writers on Food. With me, editor Peggy Wolf and contributors Mary Kay Shanley and Jeremy Jackson. And if this is sparking some memories for you, please feel free to share. Give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And you really, Mary Kay, you describe all the dishes at the table mm-hmm. at that Thanksgiving meal. And of course, there are a lot of traditional Thanksgiving dishes, but just describing your family tradition, so many of us had for so many years the exact same meal.
That's right.
No deviation.
No.
Oh, you year could, after
you
year.
Weren't, that's why Jerry got so upset, my cousin, who was a big cattle farmer. And he got really upset because there wasn't shredded carrots or crushed pineapple or miniature marshmallows. It was these little white balls. And he just didn't do that. Except that she did.
Right, right. Well, I never realized my grandma was kind of a rebel because she didn't like turkey and she didn't like to make turkey. So we never had turkey for Thanksgiving.
Whoa.
But for every holiday, we had an identical meal we always had ham and we always had baked potatoes and we always had Waldorf salad mm-hmm. with the mini colored marshmallows, one with dressing, one without. And, you know, every year it was exactly the same. And this takes us to some of the real Midwestern staples, as you describe them, like meatloaf. And what were some of the other Midwestern staples that your contributors came up with?
Okay, so I'm just going to take a quick look in the table of contents because I did want to pay homage to our Midwestern staples, which to me includes beef. It includes pork. It includes cereal grains and obviously sweet corn. So I did get essays from all my contributors, some of my contributors on these topics. But I went beyond holidays, fairs, and events like the Indy 500, the holiday of Thanksgiving, and then it's kind of a loosely organized T of C, but the Midwestern Sweet Tooth is the final one. Jeremy's essay closes the book. But we have invention here. The Bundt cake pan came from Minnesota. And do we all have Bundts stored away in our kitchens?
Yes, we do.
Bonnie Jo Campbell was making homemade fudge for people she loved. So anyway, pie, pie, pie. That's a nod to the orchards in the Midwest. You know, the one of my contributors, Carol Haddix, who was the former editor of the Chicago Tribune food section for 31 years, she has a second home up in the Lolano Peninsula in Michigan, which is the heart of cherry country. 80% of the cherries that we eat come from that area. So, but I took on cherry pie myself. There was only going to be one.
Well, and what are some of the other, just from growing up in Iowa, Jeremy, what are some of the real Midwestern staples that stick in your mind?
Oh, gosh. You know, it certainly is that kind of core meat and potatoes, you know, meal. I'm trying to think what else. Definitely, you know, bread. You know, like rolls, especially, you know, I don't know, probably, you know, at some point we switched over to sandwich bread. But for a long time, the farm wives would make rolls probably every day or very close to it. And a lot of the quick breads, like the cornbreads and the biscuits, mm-hmm. Were a daily staple because you could you could if you had some biscuits or cornbread, you could it sort of rounded out the meal. You could take just add some, you know, some beans and a little bit of meat, maybe not a lot, and it filled out, you know, the meal. I don't, because I think portions of meat, and I think meat used to be more of a luxury than it is these days, and so I think those quick breads were a key component to a lot of the kitchens in the early to mid 20th century.
Well, and I always think about goulash, but I was an adult before I learned that goulash didn't necessarily mean elbow macaroni noodles.
Right, right.
Mary Kay, did you have any staples you want to add?
Well, when I was growing up, I remember at our house, every Sunday we had, for dinner, every Sunday, we had either fried chicken and mashed potatoes and gravy and green beans or corn and iceberg lettuce and white bread. Or we had roast beef, mashed potatoes and gravy, green beans or corn and white bread and iceberg lettuce every Sunday. And it never seemed odd to me that we never had anything else. I mean, it was one or the other. It was very lockstep. But that was all right. The 50s were a lockstep time.
And Peggy, you have something you want to add?
I want to add cheese. This is a Midwestern staple, and I actually live near Kraft. They built their monster of a plant in Northfield, Illinois, and a stone's throw from my house. No, I think traveling through Wisconsin, as I have done for years, it is cheese mania wherever you go.
Yeah.
So I do have an essay on cheese. It's written by Gail Gand, pastry chef, who forged a relationship with a farmer, goat cheese farmer in southern Indiana, whose cheeses rival those of the French.
Well, we will continue our conversation in a moment. We're going to take a short break. We've been having some trouble with the phone, so if you tried to call and didn't get through, try again. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Things seem to be working. Now, you can also send us an email at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We have a lively discussion about favorite kinds of pie happening on Twitter and on our Facebook page. I'm talking with the contributors of the new collection, Fried Walleye and Cherry Pie, Midwestern Writers on Food. The editor, Peggy Wolf, is here, and contributors Jeremy Jackson and Mary Kay Shanley. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Boy, I love Java, sweet and hot. Whoops, Mr. Moto, I'm a coffee pie. Shoot me the pot, now pour me a shot. A cup. Oh, slip me a slug from the wonderful mug. I'll cut a rug till I'm stuck in the jug. A slice of onion and a raw one.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we are celebrating Midwestern food with the contributors of the new collection, Fried Walleye and Cherry Pie, Midwestern Writers on Food. With me today is the editor, Peggy Wolf, who is based in Chicago, and two Iowa writers who are included in the collection. Mary Kay Shanley is here. She's author of Our State Fair, Iowa's Blue Ribbon Story, and many other books. And Jeremy Jackson is also here, author of the Cornbread book and many other books as well. And Jeremy, your essay focuses on lemon meringue pie. Could you read a little bit for us?
Absolutely. And the context here briefly is just sort of the church basement potlucks of yesteryear. Though my grandmother contributed all manner of foods to 100 of her 50-plus year membership in her Baptist church, she was, at least during my childhood, most likely to bring her lemon meringue pie. It was perfection. That is not hyperbole. That is established fact. Her pie had a billowy meringue that did not weep. It had a lemon custard that did not slump. It had a flaky crust that did not sog. It was, as I have written elsewhere, cut into 8 pieces that the first 8 people in line took. All the people who did not get a piece of that pie spent the rest of the day with a shadow upon their hearts, a shadow the shape and size of a piece of Mrs. Jackson's lemon meringue pie. And though we have the recipe, and though my mother and I are both accomplished and capable bakers, and though my mother had, in fact, on more than one occasion witnessed my grandmother's making of the lemon meringue pie and taken mental notes as to the particular techniques employed, neither she nor I can make the lemon meringue pie so that it matches the quality of grandma's pie. Our pies weep, even if just a little bit. They sog slightly. The custard slumps. They taste very good, mind you, even extremely good, and they would generally put any truck stop lemon meringue pie to shame, but they are not hers.
That's wonderful. And you can't, you feel like you can't recreate it?
I gave up. I gave up. I don't try anymore. It's just, I mean, I think that's with a lot of recipes. I think you have someone in your family that made a recipe for years. They own it. And you can make it. You can do it. You might even actually have the actual recipe, which we do. But somehow, you know, it's not the same when grandma didn't make it, or it's not the same. You know, it's just different. And so I let her have ownership of that pie. That is her pie forever, as far as I'm concerned.
And so every time you make it, even if it's wonderful, mm-hmm. it's not quite good enough?
Well, you know, it's hard to match the perfection of the way things are in one's memories, of course. So that's
right.
Part of the problem, I believe.
I think a lot of us have that problem. I'm fortunate to not have a lot of great cooks in my background. So. That helps out a lot. If you'd like to join our conversation, give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org or join in on the favorite pie conversation on Facebook or Twitter. We have a couple of interesting selections. Andrew says sour cream peach is his favorite pie. Mm. From Fifi, ground cherry. So there may be some new recipes you want to try after getting in on that conversation. Let's go to the phones. We have, and I'm sorry, I'm missing your name. My software is having a hard time today. A caller from Polk City. Who am I talking to?
Yes, hi, it's Abby.
Hi, Abby. What would you like to talk about?
Well, I wanted to mention that when my husband and I were first married, we lived in Dubuque, and the Catholic churches up there for their fall festivals had a very interesting tradition of serving turkey dressing sandwiches, which was basically a big portion of bread from the turkey dressing inside a hamburger bun. And I have never seen that anywhere else. They were tasty, a little bit filling, but they were tasty. And I hope you'll get to the topic of the tradition of relish trays and homemade pickles. Mm.
All right.
Thank you so much,
Abby. So has anybody else had a turkey dressing sandwich?
No.
I have not heard of that.
No, not heard of that. No.
Did any of the contributors write about homemade pickles?
They did not. No one picked that one.
Next book for that as well.
Nobody picked Crisco. All the pie bakers.
Right.
What will we do without Crisco? That's from Ohio.
Right. Well, and most of the pie recipes that I read about included lard.
Uh-huh.
So
mm-hmm.
apparently we're late adopters of Crisco, at least
I still use lard.
Yeah.
And our daughter in L.A., where we're going to go this year, she makes the pies, but she can't find lard in the store.
Mm.
So it's all butter.
An all butter crust, mm-hmm. which I personally think
it's
is
okay.
delicious
it's okay.
as well. So, Mary Kay, back on the farm, did people make their own pickles
yes. Yeah. And you'd have a relish tray, and it'd have four or five kinds of pickles. And then for Thanksgiving, they'd buy olives, which was a big deal. It's the only time we ate olives. You can't raise olives on an Iowa farm.
It was a special holiday treat.
Yeah.
Martha is on the line next from Des Moines. Hi, Martha.
Hi. When you were talking about Jell-O, I just wanted to share that I was first married in 1963, and I'm not from the Midwest, but my mother made sure that I had a copy of the Jell-O cookbook, and that's made printed by the people who produce Jell-O. It has sections for salad, sections for dessert, and sections for meat dishes using Jell-O. And every once in a while, we trot that out and regale our friends with tricolor Jell-O for Christmas or something made in the Jell-O tins that belong to my mother-in-law that my husband used as toys in the sandbox, and we cleaned up, and it's a lost art.
Oh, Martha, thanks so much for calling.
Thank you.
Yeah, I remember the first time I was presented with a Jell-O with cottage cheese mixed in, and
yes.
I balked. Lime Jell-O with cottage cheese. There's a song about that, too. Lime Jell-O cottage cheese surprise. All right. Let's go now to Bill on the line in Ames. Hi, Bill.
Hi. Bill.
What would you like to talk about?
No, I was just mentioning the when I'd called in, I'd mentioned the sort of the old lunch counter where all the farmers would collect in the back of the grocery store. And if you get kumla and ham on a Thursday night, then everything's fine.
And what is kumla?
It's basically just dumplings and ham. It's like a boiled stew of...
I'm guessing that's a... Is it a Scandinavian?
It's a Norwegian
thing. Yeah, all right.
Yeah, it's a... You can get it at Harlan's on Thursdays.
All right.
Story City.
All right. Well, thanks for sharing, Bill. You can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. You can also tweet us at IPR Talk or post on our Facebook page. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This one's from Jen. She says, we always have rice pudding and anise candy at our Thanksgiving. I've only really noticed a resurgence of locally grown foods within the past 5 years or so. A lot of people seem to think that Iowa and the surrounding states grow all their own food, but... that's not what I experienced, even though I was raised on a farm. And, you know, we've talked a lot about that movement on the show. Anise candy is one of those things that kind of surprises me. And you get things that show up on the holidays that have that anise flavor that are part of family traditions. It's not a flavor that I really enjoy, but sometimes I think we make things because the taste brings back memories, not because we necessarily like it. What do you think, Mary Kay?
Oh, absolutely. When we go to L.A. next week to celebrate with our kids, our daughter will fix everything that we fixed, except she'll add pomegranate juice to something, and she'll have lumpia because our son-in-law is multi-ethnic, and she'll have Mexican food because he's part that, he's part Filipino, and he's part Japanese. So but the staples are still there. Still there.
Jeremy, did you have something you wanted to add?
Well, I mean, I think, yeah, there are certain things. I think there's, you know, like anise candy, like there's probably a reason you only make that at Christmas because you don't really like it that much. But it is. It's like part of the tradition. But you bring it out once a year and you said, yep, I remember that candy.
And right.
And see it again next year.
Right. John in Iowa City couldn't stay on the line, but he wants you guys to talk about scallop potatoes and ham, which I guess since nobody picked pork, this shocks me that considering, I mean, in Iowa, there's a lot of pork eaten.
Well, and I had five writers who have Iowa connections. Still, nobody picked pork. So
maybe they thought it was too obvious.
Kind of had to assign that one.
But scallop potatoes and ham certainly shows up a lot.
That's scallop potatoes is almost its own staple in itself. I mean, but it takes the certainly mashed potatoes. You know, it outclasses mashed potatoes. But there's a real art to scallop potatoes. It looks easy, like you just slice them and pour some milk on them and cheese. But it's tricky.
Well, and it's certainly a favorite for potlucks.
Yes.
And Jeremy, I loved your description of those church basement potlucks and how the dessert table was at least twice as big.
I do think I'm just remembering it as twice as big.
I don't know. That matches up with my memory.
Yeah. But we would be remiss if we didn't mention casseroles. Casserole, anything you bake in a casserole dish, whether it's baked beans or a zucchini casserole, a green bean casserole, those are certainly potluck staples, but also holiday, you know, staples around the Midwest.
And I'm sorry, again, I'm having a little bit of a software problem. Caller from Grinnell, who am I talking to?
Suzanne.
Hi, Suzanne. What would you like to talk about?
Well, actually, it picks up on that casserole. I'm not from the Midwest originally, and it's my observation that this particularly the foods for holidays are things that you can bake ahead because in the farm tradition, there's so much going on that if you can get up early or, you know, late at night, make something and then just reheat it, so the casseroles make sense. But I also want people to when did cream of mushroom soup become the staple?
Well, and And Mary Kay, you wrote about that because you wrote about when the green beans on the farm transitioned from home canned green beans to green bean casserole with cream of mushroom soup.
And they still do that. And our daughter still does that.
My husband can't celebrate Thanksgiving without that.
Yeah, have to have it with the soup and the French fried onions on top. And I always thought fresh green beans that were canned in the farm kitchen or my mother's kitchen in Webster City were always better, but that I didn't win that one. Del Monte won that.
Right. Yeah. Well, and I think that was one of those things that came out of the 1950s. It was a convenience food, right?
It was. And those were new. Those were new.
Absolutely. Let's get back to the phones. And Marilyn is on the line in Perry. Hi, Marilyn.
Hi. I grew up in Iowa, as did my children, but I have a daughter-in-law in Canada. And we had Thanksgiving with her where she makes the traditional dishes that they have always eaten in her family. And it includes all these root vegetables. She'll make turnips and rutabagas and parsnips. And we never had those in the Midwest. I wonder why not.
We eat potatoes.
Yeah. And carrots. Potatoes, carrots, beans, and corn.
Right. Mm-hmm. So why not? What do you guys think?
Well, I mean, I'm thinking about my father's memories of his childhood in Missouri. They had to eat a lot of turnips. So it was, but they didn't like it. But it was simple to grow, and it was like a lot of calories. And so they ate a lot of them. So I think maybe there's some negative associations with root vegetables, some of the root vegetables and I don't know, hard times. So once you could afford not to eat them, I think a lot of people moved on. But there certainly is – the Midwest has lost touch with a lot of the great root vegetables. They're coming back, though.
Mm-hmm. Brian is on the line from Arkansas. Hey, Brian.
Yes, ma'am.
Hi.
How are you?
Good. You're not in the Midwest.
Not Midwest.
No, actually, I'm not from the Midwest. You got my attention when you were talking about the Jell-O and different Jell-Os and stuff. Well, my mother had a recipe that my wife had taken and perfected, and she calls it a pink stuff. It's got whipped cream, cherries, the little bitty tart oranges in it with walnuts and pecans, and she mixes it all together and makes a side dish, which is either good with your turkey and dressing, or you can actually eat it as a dessert. And so I just thought that I might mention that.
All right. And I think I've heard that referred to as fluff here.
Yes, that's the whole genre of Jell-O desserts in the fluff category. They're pretty good, though.
Right, absolutely. Just because they're Jell-O doesn't mean they're not tasty, right?
Yes.
All right. Well, we are pretty much out of time, but is there one thing that must be on your Thanksgiving table, each of you, in the next 40 seconds? Peggy, is there one thing you can't do without?
Okay, so being here in Iowa, I went to a grocery store and I bought butter from Iowa, organic butter, because I am making biscuits and I want that Iowa whipped butter with honey.
Nice. Mm-hmm. All right, Mary Kay?
Well, we have turkey and two of our three kids don't like turkey, and I told them it didn't matter. Every year we will have turkey.
I have to get back to pie. Pumpkin pie, although to be true to my Missouri upbringing, sweet potato pie definitely has to be there.
I love that line, Mary Kay, when somebody brought a sweet potato dessert with marshmallows and everybody in your family agreed that marshmallows belong in s'mores and Jell-O, not on sweet potatoes. But in Missouri, they can be on the sweet potatoes,
yes,
right?
Yes, I guess so. Yes.
All right. Thank you all so much for being here today.
Thank you for having
Thank
us.
Thank you for having us.
We've been talking about the new collection, Fried Walleye and Cherry Pie, Midwestern Writers on Food. And with me in the studio, the editor, Peggy Wolf, and contributors, Jeremy Jackson and Mary Kay Shanley. And that conversation about favorite pies will continue on our Facebook page and our Twitter feed as well. You can join us. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. And if you go to our Facebook page, also take a look at a post about what the most meaningful part of your holiday celebration is. We would like to hear about your holiday and what makes it special to you. Look for that post as well. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa.
I'll have two eggs over light, homemade apple pie, cold slaw as a side order.